This episode is sponsored by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. When we're hiring new starters, there's always quite a bit of back and forth going on, both with candidates and within our own team. And I think we all know we could have got there a little bit quicker. To be honest, I wish we just used Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/intelligence squared. Just go to Indeed.com/intelligence squared right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/intelligence squared. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. This episode is sponsored by Factor. Warmer days are here. Fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. With Factor's menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto, you can get going on your wellness goals in time for summer. Or maybe next summer, you do you. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. Make today the day you kickstart a new healthy routine. What are you waiting for? With 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. Crush your wellness goals this month with dietitian-approved meals and ingredients that you can trust. Make your day delicious from breakfast to dessert. Stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. Treat yourself to restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon. Keep kitchen time to a minimum. Factor meals are ready in 2 minutes. No shopping, prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Enjoy effortless support for your lifestyle, choosing from 6 menu preferences to help you manage calories, maximize protein intake, avoid meat, or simply eat well-balanced. Head to factormeals.com/intelligence50 and use code intelligence50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code intelligence50 at factormeals.com/intelligence50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. On today's podcast, Emily Oster, the economist whose expert eye for finding the story in data is helping parents and carers potentially raise happier families. She'll be discussing her latest book, The Unexpected. Joining Emily in conversation for this episode is another sharp mind with facts and figures, Tim Harford. Tim is senior columnist at the Financial Times, host of the Cautionary Tales podcast, and among his other great reads is author of his first children's book, The Truth Detective. Let's join Tim now with more.
It's one of those great partnerships, parenthood and economics. Well, if that doesn't quite make sense to you, it will after the next half hour. My guest today is Emily Oster. She describes herself as being on a mission to empower parents by providing the data and tools they need to make confident decisions. Emily is Professor of Economics at Brown University. She is also the founder and CEO of Parent Data, which is a data-driven guide to pregnancy and parenting. And she's a New York Times best-selling author whose books include Expecting Better, Crib Sheet, The Family Firm, and most recently, The Unexpected. Emily, welcome to Intelligence Squared.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm delighted you're here as well. Let's talk. I want to talk about economics. I want to talk about parenting. I want to zoom in on your new book, The Unexpected. Do all of those things in the next half hour or so. Let's start with at least an introduction to The Unexpected. What inspired you to write that book, and what is it about?
So I've been writing about pregnancy and parenting for a long time. My first book, Expecting Better, came out over a decade ago now. And in that time, I've talked to a lot of people who have been pregnant, and sometimes everything went great and they want to say, you know, thank you so much for telling me I could have sushi. But often, or at least sometimes, people encounter problems, medical issues, pregnancy loss, complicated pregnancies. And the questions that I would get repeatedly were, how do I navigate another pregnancy after this? How do I understand what happened to me? Is it going to happen to me again? And this book, The Unexpected, which is about navigating pregnancy after complications, is really about answering those questions, about using data to explain to people what happened to them, but also what's the recurrence risk? What is it likely to happen again? And then giving them language to navigate with their doctor, how to move forward with another pregnancy or without another pregnancy. And you know, it's a book, my co-author Nate Fox and I sort of talk about it as a book that we hope nobody needs to read, but we really want to have be there if you do need it.
And we should probably, you've used this quite general and maybe slightly euphemistic term, complications. I mean, we should talk about what does it mean to have had a pregnancy with complications? What sort of things are we talking about?
So about 50% of pregnancies are affected by one of the complications we talk about in the book. And that ranges from first trimester miscarriage. So something like 25% of pregnancies, of conceived pregnancies, end in miscarriage. There are complications later, things like preeclampsia, preterm birth, gestational diabetes, hyperemesis, which is severe vomiting. There are other forms of pregnancy loss, stillbirth, second trimester miscarriage. And then we also talk about things that can happen after, during labor, during birth, or after, postpartum mental health challenges, trauma during birth. So there's a really wide range of complications. And I think one of the points of the book is to be clear that these complications are not rare. I mean, individually, many of them are rare, but in an aggregate, again, it's about 50% of pregnancies are affected by one or more of these complications. And so that's a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, so we're basically saying that if you take the sort of the classic fairy story pregnancy, you get pregnant, you get big, the baby comes out, you're fine, the baby's fine, everything's fine, there's nothing to worry about. That basically describes about half of pregnancies.
About half of pregnancies, exactly. And it's about half of pregnancy, and it's going to be less than half of women. Because if we think about, you know, any individual woman having multiple pregnancies, the chances that you have one of these complications in one of your pregnancies, it's high.
So I want to dig a bit deeper and talk about some of the specifics and some of the advice that you give in The Unexpected. It's a very sensitively written and very thought-provoking book. Before we get to any of that, a lot of people will be thinking to themselves, I cannot believe I'm listening to two economists talk about pregnancy. And we both have, in our own ways, experience of pregnancy. Your experience is slightly different to mine, but I have been on the sidelines of four pregnancies, one of which was complicated and three of which were not. But, you know, other than that, people might say, well, what on earth qualifies you to be talking about this? Why would an economist write a book about pregnancy, let alone... How many is it now, Emily? Is it? It's basically four, really, about pregnanthood, parenthood. So, what qualifies an economist to talk about such things?
So, my expertise within economics is really in data, and the thing that I think I do best is data translation and trying to help people understand what we can learn from data and evidence, and thinking about how that can inform our lives. And when I got pregnant, I thought about those tools as very naturally translating to the questions that I had during pregnancy. So I wanted to know, you know, can I have sushi? What's the problem with that? And the way that I wanted to encounter that problem was to say, well, let me look at the data. Let me look at what is the actual size of this risk? How much larger is it during pregnancy? And when I came to think about, you know, should I have an epidural or what's the value of bed rest? I had all of those same kinds of approaches. And so my writing about this comes from there. It comes from the idea that data can be helpful to us in thinking through the questions that we face in pregnancy, in parenting, and that we can engage with that data and think about these decisions for ourselves. I mean, I'm very clear in my books, like I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to deliver your baby, but I am an expert in thinking about data, in analyzing data, in understanding causality versus correlation. And those are the skills that I'm trying to bring to help people navigate their pregnancy and parenting journeys better.
So people have doctors, or here in the UK, often midwives. So what's wrong with just asking your doctor? Why would you, as a pregnant mother, be looking at the data rather than just asking a medical professional?
So I think there's two answers to that, although maybe they're really one answer. So our time with our providers is limited. So you do not, and this is especially true in the US, although I think it's true everywhere, the time that you have with your OB is, you know, in a given appointment, maybe 6 or 7 minutes. And you, as a pregnant person or as a new parent, you have a lot of questions, and many of those questions there will not be time for. We are going to use that time much more effectively if you are better prepared coming in. So I will often talk about my books as almost like homework. Like, here is a background on how you should think about these problems. And then you can come into the conversation with your doctor better informed and better able to have that conversation. I think it is also true that in general, there is a lot in the data which isn't necessarily translated correctly into medical advice. So sometimes I will say, you know, I don't think that the evidence supports the medical advice that we're giving. And I'm trying hard to show people why I disagree there and help them navigate through making their own choices. But actually, a lot of it, and this is especially true in the unexpected, a lot of this is really about giving people the background that they can better engage with those conversations.
Am I hearing a very, very diplomatically you suggesting that sometimes the doctors are not driven by the data as much as they should be?
Yeah, they're not always driven by the data as much as they should be. And I think one issue is that data is actually separating causality from correlation is really hard. And there are a lot of places where I think that many of our recommendations are based on correlations rather than causality. So breastfeeding is a good example. It's one I talk about a lot in my second book, in Crib Sheet. There are a lot of claims made about the value of breastfeeding. If you breastfeed your kid, you know, they'll be smart, they'll be skinny, they'll, like, all of these long-term benefits. But when you dig into the data, almost all of those are correlation and not causation. Not literally all of them, but almost all of these long-term claims are just based on studies that are not good.
So, I mean, what we're saying here is that it really is true that kids that are breastfed do tend to end up doing better and flourishing more, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the breastfeeding that did it. So what else would have done it? Just work this through for us.
Yeah, so like IQ is a good example, or test scores. So you almost always see that kids who are breastfed have higher test scores than kids who are not. That's a very, very robust correlation. When you look at the characteristics of their moms, they tend to themselves have higher education, have more resources. They tend to themselves do better on tests. And this is because the decision to breastfeed is wrapped up in a lot of other features of people. It's very difficult to separate the breastfeeding part from the other things. When we do a better job separating that out, we don't see these effects anymore. So some of my favorite studies of breastfeeding and IQ tests take advantage of sibling comparisons, where you can say, you know, I have two siblings, same mom, and one of them is breastfed and one of them is not, and you don't see any IQ test differences there. That's where you're holding it constant. So that's kind of what I'm trying to get at with some of that evidence.
So let's focus a bit on the unexpected in particular. So this work that you've written with Dr. Nathan Fox about these complicated pregnancies, these pregnancies that don't necessarily go as everyone would hope. Does society provide enough support to women who are experiencing or have experienced complicated pregnancies? And do doctors provide enough support?
I think doctors provide amazing support. I think society provides very poor support. You know, partly a lot of these complications are quite hidden and people don't really want to hear about them. You know, when you ask somebody like, how's the baby? How are things going? Our kind of expectation is that they'll be like, oh, it's great. The baby's wonderful, you know, and nobody really wants to hear, well, yeah, I like the baby, but I have fourth degree vaginal tear. And, you know, here's all the details of what that looks like. You know, we're not welcoming of that kind of feedback. And I'm not saying everyone would like to share those kind of details, but it does make many of the harder experiences feel like one is experiencing them alone. I think when we get into medicine, like, this is a place, and I'm really glad that this book was written with a doctor, because I think there is so much of navigating the complications which require talking to your provider. And I think providers ultimately really want to help. They want to do this. There's such a large knowledge gap in many of these cases between what people understand about their history and what happened to them and what the doctor understands, and figuring out a way to fit those together so we can get kind of an outcome that aligns with the values and beliefs and preferences of a patient and also their medical reality. That's what's really hard about that conversation.
Yeah. I mean, could you give me an example of this knowledge gap where the mother might have one perspective and the doctor or healthcare provider would know something different?
Yeah. So let me give you a couple of examples. So one is, when I was doing press for this book, I talked to somebody who told me she had had a postpartum hemorrhage with her second child. And until she read the book, she had no idea what that was. No one had said, you know, here's what happened and here's why it happened and here's the chance that it will happen again. Nobody had explained this at all to her. And I think that's just a failure. Basically, when somebody has a serious complication, they should understand what it was. There's then a question of kind of navigating afterwards. And here I would say our best, kind of the most classic example is what to do after you've had a C-section.
Yeah.
So in the US, the advice after you've had one C-section, there's a question of whether you would like to have a repeat C-section with another baby or whether you would like to try for a vaginal delivery. And both of those have costs and benefits. They have sort of medical risks, and the medical risk varies quite a lot depending on, say, what was the reason for the C-section in the first place. And there's also a lot of individual preference about how much do you care about having a vaginal birth? How important is that to you? Do you want more children afterwards? So that this is a case where, like, what we call shared decision making is incredibly crucial, because no one person in that decision can actually make the decision. So a doctor cannot know what the right decision is for a person, and a person can't really know what the right decision is for them, because everyone has to bring their own expertise.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting set of issues, I think, that arises where people have their own emotions, they've got their own preferences. The doctors will have knowledge, and then there's all this background information that, you know, we tend to describe with this phrase, you know, what the data say. But of course, what the data say can be tremendously informative, but also they can be very thin. I mean, there's so much that's not conveyed in the data about these individual circumstances. So I think it's a really interesting challenge to put all those things together. What advice would you give in trying to combine the data, the medical advice, the parental preferences or the emotions, everything that's going on?
Be structured. I mean, one of the things we talk about all the time in the book, which I think is relevant for these decisions, but actually relevant in a huge number of other medical cases as well, is we don't think enough in advance about how the conversation will go. And what are the things we are trying to get out of some interaction? So we come into the doctor like, let's solve this problem. Well, again, there's not that much time. And let's solve this problem is super vague. And so thinking, like, what should I do? Okay, well, we need a better frame for our card conversations. Like, what are my options? What are the benefits of this? What are the costs of this? Again, like, you're absolutely right. Data is not going to boss you in almost any of these cases. It's not going to be super clear from the data exactly what to do. It's one input, but we got to wrap it around a decision-making structure. I mean, you know, you're an economist. It's like economics, like two things, right? It's data and decisions. And I think this is where the decision piece actually confronting there are costs, there are benefits. You know, how should we weigh them? Recognizing people face trade-offs. Like, there's no, often in these cases, there's nothing perfect. Like, we wish that we could be like, you know what? Here's the perfect solution where everything, we can guarantee everything will go well. Like, that's off the table. We got to figure out, like, what's the best option within this constrained set that we have. And if we can sort of approach things in the right way, we're going to be much more likely to get to a good answer than if we come in sort of totally unscripted, which is like, let's fix this problem or tell me what to do, which is never going to lead you to something where we've combined all these factors correctly.
Yeah. Tell me a bit more about this. You have this idea of a script. You should have a script when you're coming in to deal with a healthcare provider, especially for the first time. So talk me through what that is and how it helps.
Exactly what it is going to depend on your circumstance. I mean, we talk in the book about kind of four for an initial conversation, sort of four ideas that one might start with. So a question of what happened? Why did it happen to me? And there I mean not, you know, why did it happen to me? Why am I being punished? But literally, why was I particularly at risk of this? Will it happen again? It's a very concrete question. Sometimes data will help with that. And then what can I do to make it less likely to happen again? And those are four very concrete questions, which will lead you towards some answers which might help you navigate and plan for your care, rather than coming in and saying, you know, how, again, sort of how are we going to fix this? How are we going to make it better? They're to say, I need to have the understanding of both in general and my risk. And then I need to think about, you know, what is the future going to bring and how can we make that future look different than the past?
Now, I wonder if we should be using scripts, not just when talking to doctors, but they seem kind of helpful, at least for people are difficult. Scripts sound awesome.
So one of the things I talk a lot about in all of these spaces is when we're making hard decisions, that there's a lot of value in being more deliberate. And whether you think of that as a script or a structure is sort of neither here nor there. But I do think we are too eager to come into our decisions without, say, even articulating what the two choices are, and without a plan for how we're going to get to the end of that decision. So this is one of the things I talk about in the family firm, is the idea of having sort of structured, particularly for hard conversations with your partner, structured decision-making tools.
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by Rocket Money. We've all subscribed to that essential mindfulness app, cult movie streaming site, or a meal kit service that, truthfully, maybe if we're honest, we're not using as much as we thought we would. How much do you think you're paying in subscriptions every month? The answer is probably more than you think. Over 74% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about, but thanks to Rocket Money, you can feel more assured that you're no longer wasting money on the ones you forgot were ticking away in the background. With Rocket Money, you have full control over your subscriptions and a clear view of your expenses. You can see all of your subscriptions in one place, and if you see something that you don't want, Rocket Money can help cancel it with a few taps. I love how the dashboard shows you this month's spending compared to last month, so you can clearly see your spending habits. Plus, they'll help you create a custom budget and keep your spending on track. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/intelligence. That's rocketmoney.com/intelligence. rocketmoney.com/intelligence. This episode is sponsored by NetSuite. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. This episode is sponsored by Oracle. AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/squared. That's oracle.com/squared. Oracle.com/squared.
I think people listening to this, listening to two economists talk about how to plan conversations with humans, there is this sort of caricature of the economist as someone who thinks about the world in terms of, you know, logical frameworks and rational decision making. And you'll be very familiar with the work of Nobel laureate Gary Becker and rational choice. Everything's kind of marriage is rational, crime is rational. That's not particularly data driven. Becker was not particularly data driven. I'm curious as to whether you think that purely kind of logic driven view of parenting, of relationships, and so on, is helpful without the data. Can a purely theoretical perspective from economics actually tell us anything or not? Because Becker would say it could, I think.
Let me answer maybe a slightly different, like, approach in a slightly different way, which is, when you say, you know, I'm an economist and I, so I approach my family life in this sort of economist-y kind of structured way, I think people often find that quite weird and off-putting. And almost the reaction I get is, you know, well, in my family, we love each other. And, like, why isn't that enough? Like, why, like, you're telling me we need to have, like, family meetings. It's like, but we're just going to work stuff out because we love each other. I think what I would say is, like, you can love each other and still want to assign Asana tasks. I mean, there's a sense in which, like, we can have both. And I actually think that recognizing that when we are parenting and when we are running a household with someone, that part of what we are doing is, in a kind of Gary Becker style, running a small firm.
Yeah.
Right? Like, my family, there is a little bit of, like, small to medium sized enterprise structure there.
And
like, you
did,
want.
So did you, and did you say Asana tasks? I just want to.
Yeah.
So Asana is like a project management.
It's like a task, like a task manager.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I just think that's completely insane. My wife and I use Trello instead. Why would you use Asana when you could use Trello boards?
No, we during a house renovation, we used Asana, and then we have sort of like dialed. Now we basically just use a Google Suite.
Okay.
For things. So, you
know,
it's
Trello for me, but.
Difficult. But look, so, I think that there is I would like people to be able to recognize that, you know, you can really love your partner and your family, and you can have all of those kind of emotional, like, deep emotional connections. But you can also recognize that, like, we're trying to accomplish something together, and that there are some tools that could help us do that.
Yeah.
And somehow, like, I feel very grateful. I had two parents who were economists, which, like, explains quite a lot, actually. But one of the really strong messages I got from them is that was true, that you could be, like, both a very loving and close family and also super rational about how stuff was going to get done. And then I married another economist, so I was able to replicate that. So I recommend that to everyone.
Yeah.
Just marrying an economist.
I had a long-running column in the Financial Times called Dear Economist, where people would write in with their etiquette questions, like, what kind of bottle of wine should I bring to a party? Or, you know, I'm thinking of proposing to my partner and I'm trying to work out whether I should go ahead or not. And I would write these answers based on economic theory, Thomas Schelling, yeah, Gary Becker, or the latest behavioral economics. And the column wasn't my idea, it was some colleagues of mine, and they definitely meant it as a joke.
Yes.
But I ended up taking it over, and I was never quite sure whether it was a joke. Even in my own mind, I was never quite sure whether it was a joke. And that ambiguity, I think, was quite important.
Yeah. No, it's good. I once wrote something about how you could use an SS model to decide if you should dump your partner, which, you know, I think has a little bit of joking in it,
yeah.
But also
SS,
maybe it's
Stolper
true.
Samuelson, or what do we?
You know, yeah, those things, those, like, macro models. Now we're like, this is younger when I knew more about macro, but those models were like, you're iterating around some thing, you know, those macro, whatever. You can take this out.
Sorry. No. Everyone's here all
day. I'm not a great macroeconomist.
I'm not a macroeconomist either. As the macroeconomist listening, both of them listening to us are like, What are you guys doing?
It's like, what are you even talking about? We don't use those anymore.
Get back to your game theory or whatever it is that you guys do. I want to talk about pregnancy again and parenthood and these issues, but while we're on economics, I am curious. So you are a very successful woman in economics. There are not actually very many very successful women in economics, although I'm sure we can both think of counterexamples, but they are in a minority. Economics is, particularly academic economics, is notorious as being this very male-dominated profession. So I wanted to ask you about that, to what extent you recognize that description, to what extent you feel it's a problem that might be solvable, and if it is a problem, how would we solve it?
It's certainly true. I mean, I believe in data like you do, and I think that when we look out at the profession, it is male-dominated. It's more male-dominated at the top than it is at the bottom, and I think, you know, you would be hard-pressed to find a lot of women who haven't had moments of discomfort with that, and I would certainly put myself in that category. It's a hard problem to solve, I think, in part because it's really a pipeline problem. And so, you know, it's one thing to say we should promote women more, which I think largely we should, and there's a fair amount of evidence that we may undervalue, say, the contributions of female co-authors. But I think a much larger problem is getting women into economics in the first place. And that happens when they're 18.
Yeah.
Like sort of that's almost the place I'm more worried about missing than as we move up. So there's progress to be made everywhere. I would like to see us sort of think about how we can convey to kids who are 18 that like this is super interesting and cool, and it is a way to understand so much about the world and to learn so much about the world and to sort of do policy. You know, it's interesting. I've reflected a little. So now I you know, I work at Brown, but I also run Parent Data and I employ a bunch of people. And it, as it turns out, probably not surprisingly, all the people who work at Parent Data are women. And most of the people who work at Brown are men. And it means that I'm kind of code switching a lot between environments that are full of women and environments that are full of men. And that's been an interesting experience.
Yeah. Tell me more about that.
I think that, you know, one of the biggest things, and maybe this is not so much about gender, but I spend a lot of time in Parent Data working with people who have kids. And I think that there is some like tremendous value in being able to provide flexibility and also an intense, serious job to people with small children. And it's actually more than anything telling me about gender, it's actually made me rethink some aspects of, you know, remote work and the labor market and how many women we are probably losing because it's hard to provide, because many firms do not provide the flexibility that people want when their kids are 3 or 2 or even 5. And we kind of lose those people and then we don't get them back.
Do you think the side effect of COVID, that there's been the shift to more remote work or more hybrid working, has that been helpful for women, or does it just mean they still have to cope with all the childcare and no one notices and it's actually a hindrance?
So both and. I mean, I think there was certainly a period during COVID, especially early on, where it was like, now I'm a full-time parent running a homeschool and also I have this full-time job. And I think that was very challenging. And we know that fell a lot on women. We also see in the data that labor force participation for college-educated women with kids under 5 in the U.S. is basically at an all-time high post-pandemic, and I think that's remote work. That's basically people saying, like, I can stay in the labor force because I am able to, like, have the flexibility to parent in the way that I want to or need to, and that feels interesting and exciting to me.
Coming back to the subject of parenthood, I wanted to ask, I guess this is sort of a political question. Abortion has recently become unavailable in many US states. And I was curious as to how that has affected the care and the treatment of these pregnancy complications that your book is about.
Yeah, so the biggest place this overlaps is in second trimester miscarriage. The care that you would need for a second trimester miscarriage is very similar in many cases to the care that is given to terminate a second trimester pregnancy for medical reasons or for other reasons. And that medical procedure is complicated. It's not something that can be done medically. It's not something that can be done in an office, which is different from a first trimester termination or first trimester miscarriage. And many of the most heartbreaking stories that have come out in the post-Roe era are about people whose second trimester miscarriages basically went untreated because of restrictions that had been placed on doctors by legislatures. And I think that that's the place where this overlaps the most.
Do we have a sense yet of how quantitatively significant that is? Are we seeing that in the data yet? Or at the moment, is it still at the level of anecdote?
I still think we don't have the kind of data we would want there. And it's quite hard. Sometimes it's going to be quite hard to code, realistically.
So that's one disparity then in potential access to care, depending on which state in the US you live. What other disparities in the treatment of pregnancy complications have you tracked in the data, and how can we ameliorate those disparities?
I mean, the most significant disparity in complications is on race. Black women are far more likely to have one of these complications, or far more likely to have maternal morbidity, even maternal mortality, than women of basically any other race. And one of the things we've seen, there's actually some quite good work by some economists about this, but those disparities are not about income, or not entirely about income. So sometimes it's sort of easy to say, well, is race just an income proxy? And it's actually not. Black women who are in high income groups are doing far worse, even than white women in lower income groups. Suggests that there's sort of something else about race that is influencing people's experience of pregnancy. And there are a lot of different approaches to intervention there. I think there are one which I like very much that I will just highlight is doulas. So I'm sort of constantly on about how we should provide everybody with a doula during their birth.
For those who don't know, just tell us what a doula is.
A doula is a birth support person. It's not a nurse, but it's somebody with training in birth, often who has been at many births, who is there to do a variety of things. They do a variety of things. There's massage, there's birth support, there's just general support. There's some advocacy potentially, some sort of just somebody there for the patient. It turns out that's really important for reducing the risk of C-section and for other good outcomes, for having people be happy with their experience. And so that's a policy we should push on that I think would have disparate positive impacts on groups that are suffering the most from birth complications.
What are the most common misconceptions about pregnancy complications that you're trying to address in your book?
That they don't happen to everybody.
Yeah.
That they're very rare. I mean, I think that's the overwhelming sense that we get from people talking to them about their complications, is just that they felt alone. And that's if people sort of took nothing else from this, it's, this is happening a lot more than you think.
And you mentioned earlier that people don't want to hear about your pregnancy complications. I mean, is it also the case that people don't want to talk about their pregnancy complications?
Sometimes. I mean, I think it's certainly the case that many people want to be private. It's a completely reasonable choice. I suspect that there is more privacy about this, or more reluctance to talk about it, because people don't anticipate what will come on the other end. So an experience I think many people have had after having particularly a first trimester miscarriage is when you then tell somebody else, it's like, oh, I had that. I remember before I ever got pregnant, one of my friends had a first trimester miscarriage, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, I can't believe I know somebody who had a miscarriage. And of course, at the other end of my reproductive years, it's rare. There's not very many people I know who didn't. It's almost like that is more the norm.
Yeah.
And so I think that piece of it, kind of what do people expect to hear from you, is influencing a lot of how we talk about things.
I mean, I'm curious, you've written all these books, you run your own company, you're a tenured professor, you get a lot of stuff done. So I wanted to ask what the economist Tyler Cowen would call the Emily Oster production function. Like, how do you get so much stuff done?
I do a lot of outsourcing at my house, and to some extent at my job. I mean, I have a really good team at work, and I have a really good team at home. And, there are some things, like, I write pretty quickly. And so some of my pretty substantial portion of my job is writing. And that's something that I like to do, and is not super hard. And then, sometimes I don't get things done and balls drop and I try to forgive myself a little.
So what is one non-obvious piece of productivity advice that you would give to people?
One non-obvious piece of productivity advice, other than just outsource as much as you can, which is always my favorite piece of productivity advice.
Well, maybe that is, in fact, non-obvious, because people struggled to do it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have, I do think that many people under-outsource by not valuing their time as highly as they should.
And by outsource, you mean, you know, get a secretary, get a gardener, get a cleaner, get a nanny, get somebody to handle stuff that you could be doing yourself, but maybe you'd be better off running a company and writing economics papers.
Yeah, and I think recognizing the pieces of what you do outside your job that you're valuing and that are kind of that you want to do, that you think are important, and which pieces are kind of less someone else could do.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you for another non-obvious piece of advice, but so a young economist who is trying to make an impact outside academia, what's a non-obvious piece of advice that you would give them?
I find that question very difficult, because inside the academy, the reward to being visible outside the academy is very limited and possibly negative. And so sometimes people will come and say, you know, I want to be doing the things that you're doing. That's not a good piece of advice. That's not a good strategy if you're an assistant professor. I mean, I did that as an assistant professor. I wrote a book as an assistant professor. And the next thing that happened is I got fired.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky that everything worked out, and it was probably by far the best thing that could have happened to me. And I'm exactly where I should be, and it worked out great. But it was not an easy, you know, few years. And it isn't the advice I would give to someone coming up.
Not without meaning to pry a little, but... So you got fired for writing a book, or you got...
No. I wrote Expecting Better. I was told I was going to be brought up for tenure early. I wrote Expecting Better. It came out, and then I was turned down for tenure.
Yeah.
So, you know, it, like, and everyone will tell you, like, when you get turned down for tenure, there's a lot of things, and I think that the people who turn me down are very happy with their decision, and ultimately, I think it was exactly the right decision for everybody, but I don't think it was helpful to have been so publicly visible outside the academy. I don't think that that's what people expect, and that's not what we value in academia. That's not what we're doing here.
Yeah,
that's all we're doing as a professor, and so it's a complicated piece of advice.
Yeah. So your non-obvious piece of advice is maybe don't. Interesting, and so. One final thought on this contribution of our great subject economics to the wider world. I mean, 15 years ago, I would have been all in favor of what's sometimes called economic imperialism. I think that's a slightly loaded term, but the idea that economists have this, you know, huge amount to contribute to the other social sciences, and to every, you know, we can get out there. We got the data skills, we've got the communication skills, we've got the logical frameworks. We're just going to go out in there and help. And now I wonder a little whether we aren't sometimes straying into Dunning-Kruger territory of that point, right, where you know stuff, and then you suddenly get to a point where you actually don't have any idea what you're doing, but you have no way of telling that you have no idea of what you're doing. Is there a risk that economists kind of step over the Dunning-Kruger threshold sometimes?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's important often for us to remember, both individually and collectively, like, what is the set of expertise that you have? And so, like, when I write, people ask, like, well, you know, what are you an expert in? Like, I know what I'm an expert in. I'm an expert in data. I'm an expert in, like, what is causality and what separating correlation from causation, that's what I write about in my academic work. Like, that is a thing that I know. But I'm able to learn and have some subject matter expertise in some other spaces. But I think recognizing, like, having subject matter expertise in one space doesn't mean that you have it in another space. And having this kind of expertise doesn't mean you don't need to incorporate ideas from elsewhere. And so I always think this question of just asking ourselves, what is it that I'm bringing to this that's new? And I tend to think with economists, it almost always is something about data, and some of the best kind of not pejorative economic imperialism is when the data that we bring to the table or the concepts of causality and how to interpret, how to get to causality, that that is better than what's come before. But we can also be, I think, a little bit too dismissive of other fields' contributions, and you got to be a little careful.
Well, I suppose the natural thing to do is to collaborate. And if you're trying to write about the economics of ecosystems, collaborate with an ecologist. If you're trying to write about epidemiology, collaborate with an epidemiologist. If you want to write about chaotic systems, collaborate with a physicist. You've collaborated with a physician.
Sure.
In writing this book. So do we collaborate enough? And are there obstacles to collaboration between fields that there shouldn't be?
The most significant obstacle to collaboration in the academic world is that you don't want to publish in the same journals. So that basically the kinds of things that economists are trying to do, the kinds of places they're trying to put their papers are very different than the places that physicists or computer scientists are putting their papers. And people are all trying to achieve within their field on by the standards of the discipline that they're in. And I think that's a huge barrier to collaboration, particularly early in people's career. You know, I think that, you know, writing a book, like, that doesn't really have value for, in some sense, either me or my co-author, except that we think this is a valuable thing in the world and has other piece of value. But as an academic exercise, it doesn't have value, but it has the same kind of value for both of us. That's where I think collaboration gets really tough inside the academy.
I've been speaking today to Professor Emily Oster, and her most recent book is The Unexpected. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to talk.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Leila Ishmael and Tom Hall. It was edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.